This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, July 20, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Today's first article is a Christian Science perspective from Suzanne Rydell. It's entitled, Authentic Truth. Who would have predicted the mental environment humanity would find itself in today? Artificial intelligence is rapidly changing how we receive information. Knowing how to discern deep fakes, manipulated images, or video challenges society. And the question, what is authentic truth, has become urgent for everyone to consider. When I asked the child what truth is, he said, it's what you say when it isn't a lie. Another child added that everyone knows what's true and what's not, even if they sometimes lie. How do the kids know that? Is knowing truth inherent in everyone? This week's Bible lesson from the Christian Science Quarterly on the subject of truth shines light on these questions. In Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, Mary Baker Eddy writes, "The time for thinkers has come. Truth, independent of doctrines and time-honored systems, knocks at the portal of humanity. Contentment with the past and the cold conventionality of materialism are crumbling away. Far above what humans create, God, divine truth, is spiritual, ever-present intelligence. This truth is knowable and practical, including to meet our needs for discernment today." To consider truth in this context, Christian Science highlights its use as a biblical synonym for God in the same way spirit, life, and love are used. God's truth acts as permanent law, as knowable as math. Searching for a knowable universal truth led me to Christian Science. Its basic proposition was logical to me, that God is divine intelligence, the holy good infinite spirit that creates man's spirituality in his likeness. But I wrestled with the question, so what is this material body? Then, while on vacation, I collapsed unexpectedly, losing my sight and the ability to speak or move, and I was in great discomfort. Frightened and not knowing what to do, my husband began reading to me from the book he was grappling with, Science and Health. Then I heard clearly and thought, "This is the truth you have been looking for." In a few moments, all symptoms completely left. I was grateful to be alive, but even more grateful to realize that God's Spirit was present and speaking directly to me. The threatening material conditions disappeared in that palpable spiritual reality. Universal truth is dynamic in consciousness, as Jesus described it when he said, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Truth does something. As humanity learns more about of the spiritual reality that Jesus taught, God's messages of truth are heard, felt, and understood. Nurturing that spiritually inspired awareness leads to new views, more intelligent insights, and more inspired solutions. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, July 20, 2026, comes from Stephen Humphreys, a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. His article is entitled, A Modern Epic Where Greece is the Word. Christopher Nolan's movie adaptation of The Odyssey features a cast of 5,000 extras. It was filmed in Morocco, Iceland, Italy, Scotland, and of course, Greece. Every aspect of the production, from ships to costumes, is historically authentic. Well, apart from Odysseus' American accent, we'll let it slide, Matt Damon. Perhaps surprisingly, for one of humankind's greatest stories, this is Hollywood's first large-scale production of it. It's an odd gap in movie history, Mr. Nolan told an interviewer. Yet, Mr. Nolan's epic arrives at a time when many colleges are ditching classics about Homer, not to mention Virgil, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Some asked, why should we bother with the classics? We explore that question in this week's magazine. The centerpiece is a conversation that I convene with three scholars. We discuss the resurgence of the classics in popular culture, their place in higher education, and why those works face ideological tussles between the left and the right. In a related story, staff writer Emily Staunton reports on young people who are learning ancient Greek to better understand the classic. Film critic Peter Rainier ponders what elements make for successful swords and sandals epics. We also compiled a guide to reading the classics, including an accessible entry point for kids, which takes us back to that central question of why the classics matter. Well, here's one reason. For a young generation accustomed to surface-level scrolling through social media, these ancient scrolls demand deep-dive immersion. One of our panelists, J. Walter Sterling, is president of a university entirely devoted to that endeavor. At St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, students embark on a great books curriculum. Many students arrive ill-prepared for the rigor it requires, says Mr. Sterling. Yet engaging with the classics helps build up essential life skills, including concentration and focus. More than that, the texts invite inquiry and contemplation. Tales such as the Odyssey ask us to explore what constitutes home, why some relationships endure, and how we're all on a quest to better understand ourselves and our true identity. You didn't need to be a college student to start reading these works. The Odyssey is not just a story for the ages, it's a story for all ages. In the panel discussion, Daniel Mendelsohn, an editor-at-large at the New York Review of Books, said, "By looking at these materials, which for whatever reason, 3 millennia worth of people have thought worth looking at, you're going to get more out of your life." The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, July 20, 2026, is entitled Odyssey Roundtable, Today's Connection to the Classics. The July 17 release of the Christopher Nolan film adaptation of The Odyssey has provoked the kind of chatter that big-budget movies always bring, that cast. But this one has also stirred conversation about the relevance of the classics in contemporary society. Stephen Humphreys, our senior culture writer, reached out to Daniel Mendelsohn, editor-at-large at the New York Review and a professor at Bard College, whose 2025 translation of the Odyssey is widely acclaimed. Walter Sterling, president of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Anika Prather, a professor at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., for an online meetup to see what some of those closest to classic literature were thinking. Notably, none of them scoffed at the mass market presentation. When we spoke, they'd only seen the trailer. But we got the feeling all three might be reaching for the popcorn. We boldly ventured, "Might it be better than the book?" Well, said one of our distinguished guests, "it's going to be different." Moderator Stephen Humphrey starts off by saying, "We're living in an era in where there's a lot of debate within higher education about the place of humanities, including the classics. Institutions of higher education are facing a demographic cliff, lower enrollment, a young generation of kids saying, 'Why should I spend the money and have all that debt and end up working at Starbucks? Is it worthwhile?' Others are saying, 'Maybe it's a better idea to study accounting or take up learning how to become a plumber.'" So there's a lot of discussion at the moment about what the role of higher education is. What is it for? So what do you say to kids who are wondering, should they study Homer's The Odyssey or go learn how to do plumbing? Panelist Daniel Mendelsohn says, "Well, I've always had the same response to this question about practicality. I luckily had great parents, and when I announced to them at the age of 18 that I wanted to major in Greek, they didn't bat an eye. You know, they never said, 'What are you going to do with that?' I always told my students the same thing. Or their parents, actually, who are concerned. And not without reason, you know. 'How are you going to put a roof over your head?' Blah, blah, blah. I always say it depends on how you define practical. You know, if you want to come out of 4 years of college and know for a fact that you're going to get a job, by all means, study accounting. That's the practical thing to do. I also say, but when your father dies, your accounting degree is not going to help you at all. But the Odyssey is going to help you. Having read great authors is going to help you. That's a different kind of practical. And I have to tell you that most of life is that stuff, not your job, you know." It's the bedrock of how to think about your life that you're getting from these texts. And you might make less money, you know, if you study English than if you study AI. But what is your life going to be like? What are the tools that you are going to have to think about what's important in life? Those you are not going to get necessarily out of your STEM degree. And you know what? It's not necessarily a competition. You can read the classics and be a scientist, like my father, like a lot of people. You know, I do think it's important to frame it not as some dire zero-sum game. By looking at these materials, which for whatever reason, 3 millennia worth of people have thought worth looking at, you're going to get more out of your life. The unexamined life is really not worth living. I have news for you, and so that's what I always tell them. Define practicality. Let's start there. Stephen Humphreys replies, Walter, how about you? Tell me about your connection to the classics, and what is your experience of students who are discovering them for the first time? Panelist Waller Sterling replies, I was a seeker like young people are, and a seeker for meaning. And we look for it in so many places. We look for it in pop culture, in art, in music, with our friends, in politics, religion, and all those things that are swirling around us. I think for some people, if you're able to go into classic texts of literature and philosophy from the tradition and engage with them in a certain way, you realize that there are deep reservoirs that in a way are deeper often than the things you are encountering on the surface in your immediacy and in your present world. Stephen Humphrey asks Annika, what is your response to this cultural moment we're in now of interest in the classics again? Annika Prather replies, I feel like reading the Odyssey helps you understand a lot of literature. I've not been able to prove it, but I have a sneaking suspicion because Zora Neale Hurston was classically educated. Their eyes were watching God as her version of the Odyssey, because it follows a similar pattern of Odysseus. The main character is Janie, and she starts off at home, somehow wanders away from home, ends up in a relationship that she doesn't need to be in, and then ends up back home after that relationship doesn't work. This is a really broad summary I'm giving, but it follows a similar pattern of the Odyssey, and I feel like the story of the Odyssey has formed a foundation for a lot of storytelling across cultural lines. When I read Their Eyes Were Watching God, I had already read the Odyssey, and so immediately I'm like, oh my gosh, she's Odysseus. But that is a story of us all, right? We're always on this journey of self-discovery and eventually coming back to the roots of ourselves. The things we thought we didn't want to be a part of, we go away from it for a while and realize, you know what? I need to go back. You can tell there was a bit of a change in Odysseus when he came back home. He wasn't the same, right? And so you come back home, but you're a different person, ready to do more or better than what you have done before. And I think that is the journey of every human being. So I feel like for those of us who understand this tradition is not supposed to be protected by one group of people, it is the story of every human being. And this is the other thing. Like I said earlier, a lot of the Greek plays came out of these stories. So I believe that Homer and others created these epics for us to continue storytelling, to integrate it into our humanity and to our human life, and then to recreate and to continue to recreate. And that's how we keep humanity alive, by continuing to do storytelling, and that storytelling is birthed out of the stories that came before us. Stephen Humphreys then comments, the classics have been very politicized. Some on the right claim that our civilization should depend on these traditions and that the classics should be represented in a certain way, whether it's in the depiction of a scene on an urn or in a Christopher Nolan blockbuster. There's been a lot of controversy about Nolan's casting choices in The Odyssey. He cast Zendaya to play Athena and Lupita Nyong'o as Helen of Troy, and people such as Elon Musk and Matt Walsh have called that blackwashing. Ms. Prather states, one thing that came to mind because I was reading an article where they were concerned that a transgender person, Elliot Page, might be playing Achilles or another male character, and they were upset about that. As you all know, I have very deeply religious values myself. but I am a realist. And the first thing I said to myself when I read that is, you do realize that ancient Greek tragedy was only performed by men. Men were playing women. And I do struggle when people try to bring their values into a free country. Everyone should be free to live as they want to, as long as they're not hurting others. I have a real visceral response to some of these things. It frustrates me as a black woman. When different scenes from this myth are portrayed on the ancient Greek stage, men dressing up as women, portraying them, it reveals that they weren't concerned about that. There were more, just enjoy the story, because these stories are all about all of us. An African woman can be Helen. A white woman can be Helen. And I feel like a lot of these Greek authors did have this in mind. And that's why so many diverse people connect to the classics. It's because when we read them, we are drawn to these stories because we can see ourselves in these stories, right? A lot of us, when we read the Odyssey, we identify with it because we are far from home. My great-grandfather was separated from his first wife because he was sold away from her. Like we all have this experience of being away from home and just trying to get back there. And some of us have realized, you know what? We'll never get truly back to Africa because too much of our roots are now here. So we're trying to make home here. It's a book that we can really, really identify with on such a global scale. Next, Stephen Humphreys talks to Walter Sterling. Stephen says, I'm going to move over to you now to talk about the flip side of the culture wars when it comes to the classics, because there are some on the left who disdain the classics and say they are filled with justifications of slavery and that they exalt nationalism, classism, sexism, and homophobia. But there's a book by Mary Beard called Talking Classics in which she says the classics belong neither to the left or the right. In fact, she writes, the simple fact that classics belong to none of us can offer us safe space to argue about the most difficult debates we face now. So how do you view the classics amid these ideological debates, and can they function as a neutral zone for us to look at our modern world? Walter Sterling's reply, I agree 100% with what Mary Beard said there. Let me make a quick analogy, because I find myself talking about this a great deal in the year of America 250. And I'll talk to folks about what it means to read the Declaration, the Constitution, Federalist Papers, and so on. American foundational texts, I often assert. If you think you can get those texts to map onto any party platform or any one side of our contemporary ideological debates, you are going to fail. And that's part of what's brilliant about putting students together to actually read, interpret, and discuss those texts. You find complexity and ambiguity. I'm not saying they can mean just anything. This is not, you know, this is not wild relativism, but you're going to find complexity and ambiguity that can't be reduced to the terms of our normal political partisanship. You're going to find in most of them elements that are deeply tensional just along the kind of axes that we talk about. You're going to see things that look like they underwrite maybe certain traditionalist understandings of gender and family and hierarchy or something like that. And you're going to see powerfully those things critiqued and questioned and challenged. I mean, any thoughtful reader of the Iliad and the Odyssey, though both of them in different ways, is going to find things that look like celebration and valorization of warrior ideals. But boy, are you really going to find questions and critiques of those ideals? And that just runs all the way down about every single issue that activates us along these lines. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, July 20, 2026, is entitled, In Their Philosophy, Ancient Greek is a Living Language. Students of ancient Greek are making antiquity new again, diving deep into the Iliad and the Bible. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Emily Stoughton. 3 years ago, when Abigail Gefkin was at the beginning of high school, her mother asked her a question. If she didn't have to think about impressing colleges, how would she spend her time? For Ms. Gefkin, the answer was easy. I'd be reading the Iliad, she said, and she'd be reading it in its original language, she informed her mother, ancient Greek. It's such a beautiful language, just the way the alphabet looked, she recalls. I was just so fascinated by it. So for the next 2 years, Ms. Gefkin studied ancient Greek with an online Christian classical education school called Scholae Academy. And when she finished high school, she took a gap year to complete a third year of the language. Ancient Greek, it turns out, is not dead. Not quite. Indeed, as antiquity becomes new again, with the classics getting a boost from everything from TikTok trends to this month's Christopher Nolan blockbuster film, The Odyssey, a small group of devotees like Ms. Gefkin are trying to understand the Athenians in their own tongue. Justin Belote, for instance, a high school English teacher and poet from Staunton, Virginia, is fascinated by ancient Greek philosophy and history. His love of poetry led him to teach himself ancient Greek. To be able to read a language that people wrote sometimes thousands of years ago is a wild experience, he says. During Lent, Mr. Belote met weekly with another teacher to read ancient Greek passages from the Book of John in the Bible. He's not alone in this theological inclination. Benjamin Dunning, a professor of the New Testament and Early Christianity at Harvard Divinity School, says he's seen growing interest among students in applying ancient Greek to the Bible. In the past, he would have expected no more than 7 students to register for his upper intermediate ancient Greek class. Last semester, 12 students took the class. Some of his students are training for the ministry, while others are historians. Some are just wrestling with religious concepts. I've been very impressed with the students that I'm working with now, Dr. Dunning says. They don't want to go quick and shallow. They really want to dig in and get into the text very deeply. And there's only so far you can go when you're working in an English translation. Going deep is part of the philosophy of Scholae Academy, the school Ms. Gefkin attended. The ancient Greek word skolae means leisure. But leisure doesn't equal lazy, explains Edward Kotinsky, the Academy's chair of languages. The school is trying to get that balance of going deeply and having discussions and making sure that we don't have lots of busy work, he says. Proponents of the approach say this relaxed but deeper thinking can be refreshing in a high-tech society with decreasing attention spans. Swiss German University reported that the average attention span on a digital device had fallen to 47 seconds in 2024, down from 75 seconds in 2012. Learning ancient Greek takes a lot longer than 47 seconds. Indeed, studying it requires you to think very deeply and just grow your attention span, Ms. Gefkin says. During her gap year, she participated in the Catherine Project, an online forum that offers courses and reading groups focused on the classics. Her ancient Greek reading group included people of all ages, joining from India, Texas, Brazil, and Portugal. Ms. Gefkin says her classmates were from very different walks and stages of life, but who all wanted to talk about these books together. When she headed to Deep Springs College earlier this month for freshman orientation, she brought some of her own study books. She plans to become an ancient Greek and Latin teacher. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, July 20, 2026, comes from Peter Rainier. He's a contributor to the Christian Science Monitor. His article is entitled, Epic Literature, Epic Screen Adaptations. Classic stories like the Odyssey don't often make great movies. Here are some joyous exceptions. Being both a movie maven and a lit guy, I've often bemoaned the dearth of great movies adapted from great books, a thought prompted once again by the imminent release of Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. The reasons for this scarcity are legion. A great novel or short story is great, in large part not because of its plot, but because of the ways in which the author has framed his or her very personal way of seeing, of feeling. The language employed is indistinguishable from the author's vision. When William Faulkner, for example, describes a rising moon as a wan hemorrhage, it won't do for a filmmaker to express the beauty of this phase by simply photographing a moon, no matter how artfully composed. The deep degree of psychological insight in a great novel is also difficult for a movie to measure up to. A writer can plume the inner lives of characters in ways often inaccessible in film except by the finest of actors, and through very different means. It's no accident that many of my favorite literary adaptations showcase great performances. Great actors bring inner lives outward. I once asked Norman Mailer if there could be a movie as great as, say, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. He answered that it was possible, but it wouldn't be a movie of Crime and Punishment. Movies hit us in different ways than novels. One thing novels can't match, obviously, is the sheer physicality, the sheer sensuousness of the visual and theatrical experience. The movie Jaws is infinitely better than the novel. The same is true of The Godfather. It's worth pointing out that in these two instances, the source material was far from a masterpiece. It's a truism that second-rate novels often make for far better movies than first-rate ones. Great novels are great because of the web and texture of the writer's vision. They are too intimidating for most filmmakers to tackle, though the many who have tried should not be disparaged. Their attempt, after all, is often inspired by love of the book. There are, however, exceptions to this truism, which brings me to my brief personal list of best movie adaptations of great literature. Most can be streamed. To make the cut, they had to be close in quality to the book. So although I've enjoyed, for instance, some of the Jane Austen adaptations over the years, especially Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley and Emma Thompson in Sense and Sensibility, I wouldn't place these films at the top. Some of my picks may be unfamiliar to you, all the better. I envy what you have to look forward to. One caveat, please read the book before you see the movie, if at all possible. Reading it afterwards saps its strength. The Grapes of Wrath. This 1940 John Ford adaptation of the John Steinbeck novel about Dust Bowl migrants in California is almost as renowned as the book, and rightly so. It captures the faces of the dispossessed with a fierce authenticity that matches Steinbeck's prose and recalls the photographs of Dorothea Lange. As Tom Joad, Henry Fonda, who played Lincoln for Ford the year before, is at his most iconic. Great Expectations. David Lean's 1946 version of the Charles Dickens novel is for many the pinnacle of all great book adaptations. Writers often don't like the movies made from their books, though they like the paychecks. But I believe Dickens himself would have been pleased. 2 years later, Lean made an excellent Oliver Twist, and for his last film, a highly credible A Passage to India from the E.M. Forster novel. And while we're on the subject of Dickens, the Alistair Sim A Christmas Carol, not directed by Lean, is impeccable. The Heiress. William Wyler's 1949 movie, adapted from a stage play based on Henry James's Washington Square, is ferociously powerful. Olivia de Havilland, at her peak, plays the jilted heiress, and Montgomery Clift is the gold-digging suitor. It also boasts a terrific score by Aaron Copland. Another marvelous James adaptation is The Innocents, derived from his chilling otherworldly novella, The Turn of the Screw, with a career-best performance from Deborah Kerr as the imperious governess. The Leopard. Giuseppe Tomasi de Lampedusa's famous novel, set in 1860s Italy during the insurgent Risorgimento movement, was transformed by Luchino Visconti in the 1963 film into one of the most sweeping operatic movies ever made. As the noble Don Fabrizio Corbera, Prince of Salina, who recognizes his time has passed, Burt Lancaster is beyond praise. The Scarlet Letter. Lillian Gish gives one of the greatest of all movie performances in the superlative 1926 silent adaptation of the Nathaniel Hawthorne novel. Gish personally chose its director, the Swedish Victor Sorenstrom, because she felt rightly that his Scandinavian sensibility was attuned to Hawthorne's. The Member of the Wedding. Adapted from the play and novel by Carson McCullers about a lonely tomboy in the Deep South, superlatively played by Julie Harris, the 1952 dramatization is one of the most moving films ever, made about race relations and the hazards of growing up. Ethel Waters' performance as the housekeeper is legendary. The Dead. John Huston was perhaps the finest of all directors of great literature. The Dead, his final film and adaptation of The Peerless. James Joyce's story is among his very best, as rich and lived in as anything he ever did. Also high on the Huston scale is his 1951 movie of Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, even though MGM severely trimmed the release version, and his 1975 Rudyard Kipling movie The Man Who Would Be King, starring Sean Connery and Michael Caine as the hapless adventurers Danny and Peachy. And his 1956 Moby Dick has occasional passages that match Herman Melville's prose. Speaking of Melville, there is much to commend in Peter Ustinov's 1962 Billy Budd, with a young Terence Stamp as the angelic sailor Billy and Robert Ryan as his nemesis Claggart. Intruder in the Dust. The movies have mostly not been kind to William Faulkner, but this 1949 adaptation, filmed in his hometown of Oxford, Mississippi, is the exception. Juano Hernandez, one of the finest of all American actors, plays a proudly defiant black man falsely accused of murder. Carrie. No, not the sissy SpaceX shocker, but William Wyler's deeply affecting and little-known 1952 adaptation of Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie. As the wealthy married man whom Carrie, the small-town girl played by Jennifer Joan, falls for Laurence Olivier, gives perhaps his best unheralded performance. Olivier always credited Wyler, who starred him as Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights years before, with teaching him how to act for the screen. The Lady with the Dog. Anton Chekhov's short story is one of my favorites, and so is this 1960 Russian movie. It's about an affair between a married woman and a married banker vacationing in Yalta. It honors the writer while possessing a full life of its own. The same is also true of the other films discussed here. You can't ask for more. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, July 20, 2026, is entitled, For a Classical Education, Start with These Texts. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Stephen Humphreys. Interested in delving into the classics? From a traditional translation to a middle school hero, here are several suggestions on where you or your kids can get started. The Odyssey 2025 by Horner, translated by Daniel Mendelsohn. For an accessible version of Homer's epic, try Emily Wilson's 2017 translation to plain spoken language in iambic pentameter. By contrast, this translation by Mendelsohn replicates the 6-beat, 17-syllable dactylic hexameter of ancient Greece. It's not lightweight, but its prose soars. Here, for example, is a description of Hermes' flight to Calypso. Swooping down, he set foot on Pierre. Then he plunged into the sea and skimmed along the breakers like nothing so much as a tern, which drenches its sweet thick plumage in the brine as it hunts for fish. Down through the troughs of the breakers on the restless waters of the sea. Circe, 2018, by Madeline Miller. In Homer's The Odyssey, Circe is a wily antagonist with the power to turn men into animals. In Madeline Miller's spin-off novel, Circe is a misunderstood protagonist who is seeking acceptance. Does she belong to the world of gods or to the world of mortals? Miller's follow-up novel to The Song of Achilles was a bestseller and book club favorite in 2018. The Monitor's review of it that year lauded Miller for weaving powerful imagery and emotion into a rich tapestry. Talking Classics, 2026 by Mary Beard. Mary Beard starts her book with the following question. What is the point of the ancient classics? Too often, these civilizational monuments are presented as if they're museum pieces, best handled by curators wearing white gloves. Beard, a renowned British professor of ancient literature, recommends a less reverential approach. That way, it's easier to experience what she dubs the shock of the old. She invites the modern reader to discover how the ideas within works of antiquity aren't antiquated. Plato and the Tyrant, 2025, by James Rahm. Who was Plato, the pupil of Socrates, who went on to teach Aristotle? James Rahm, a professor of classic at Bard University, studies letter purported to have written by Plato. His goal is to reveal the man behind the myth. The Greek philosopher believed that an enlightened strongman, unconstrained by laws or limits on power, could solve the world's ills, which he otherwise deemed insoluble. Struggling to reconcile his philosophical ideas of justice with the tyrannical real world of politics of Syracuse, Italy, he didn't exactly measure up to the Platonic ideal. Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief, from 2025 by Rick Riordan. Imagine Harry Potter, but with a hero who wields thunderbolts instead of a wand. Contemporary teenager Percy Jackson learns that he is the son of Poseidon, god of the sea. Despite his heritage, Percy lives on terra firma. In The Lightning Thief, the first book in Rick Riordan's popular series, Percy finds himself in a training camp for demigods that includes a daughter of Athena and son of Hermes. Setting out on a quest that mirrors the journey of Odysseus, Percy faces threats from a Minotaur, Titans, and a Medusa-esque character who would like to turn him into a garden statue. The best-selling series, most recently adapted to television, offers young adult readers an entry portal into the characters and storylines of Greek mythology. Mythos, the Greek Myths Reimagined, written in 2019 by Stephen Fry. If you're a fan of Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, then Stephen Fry's series Mythos, Heroes, Troy, and Odyssey is for you. In Mythos, the British actor recounts tales of Zeus, Athena, Persephone, and others with irreverent wit and sage wisdom. For instance, he describes the goddess Gaia visiting her daughter Mnemosyne, who was busy being unpronounceable. When the Earth goddess meets Uranos, supreme ruler of the cosmos, Fry writes, Gaia listened carefully to this wise counsel, and as we all do, whether mortal or immortal, ignored it. Your Christian Science Monitor news continues for Monday, July 20, 2026, with the following news stories. As more voters warm to socialism, Trump warns of a communist threat. President Donald Trump has long assailed Democrats as radical leftists and Marxists. But after recent primary wins by self-described Democratic socialists in New York, Washington, and Denver, the president has seized on a new label to accuse the Democratic Party of wanting to jettison capitalism for an altogether different system. In recent speeches and social media posts, the president has repeatedly warned of godless communists who are making their move ahead of midterm elections that could flip one or both branches of Congress to Democratic control. Speaking at Mount Rushmore over the July 4th weekend, Mr. Trump said, "You can be a communist or you can be a patriot. You cannot be both." The Republican rhetoric echoes the Red Scares of the previous century, when the Soviet Union posed a threat to the United States and the hunt for communist sympathizers became a rallying cry for our conservatives. It fits with Mr. Trump's tendency to paint opponents as un-American or abnormal, says Robert Rowland, a professor of political rhetoric at the University of Kansas. Trump is trying to boil down every possible sin into one word by using the word communist, he says. While Democratic socialists favor greater government intervention in the economy and admire Scandinavian societies, it's a far cry from Cuba's brand of communism, in which the government directly owns businesses and restricts private enterprise. But to many voters, those distinctions might be blurred. The Cold War ended decades ago, and many Americans have only a faint understanding of either state-backed socialism or communism. At the same time, polls suggest that socialism is not the taboo it once was, which might explain Mr. Trump's rhetorical pivot. Labeling Democrats as communists might resonate among older conservatives and immigrants from regions with communist or socialist dictators. But younger voters are less fearful of socialism, associating it more with European welfare states, and are more likely to question the benefits of capitalism as it relates to their lives. By embracing socialism, left-wing candidates are giving Republicans ammunition that might make it harder for moderate Democrats in swing districts to win in November. The Democratic Socialists recently nominated in deep blue cities are likely to join like-minded House Democrats such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar, who were both first elected in 2018. This article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Simon Motlake. Supreme Court term readjusts presidential powers. In its recently concluded term, the United States Supreme Court solidified a decades-long movement concentrating executive power under the president alone, amid a broadening of presidential power in other directions. The justices did not give President Trump victories on some of his most treasured policies, such as tariffs and birthright citizenship. However, overall, at a time of high tension between the judiciary and the executive branch, the Supreme Court has recalibrated the constitutional separation of powers to significantly empower the president's role. And while the court has pushed back on the president at times, it has been a willing partner in allowing the White House to effectively enact policies through emergencies, extending a years-long trend that has seen the High Court decide significant policy questions on its interim docket with minimal briefing. In terms of the separation of powers, the term was a mixed bag, says Jeff Powell, a professor at Duke Law School. But in his view, the mixture added to a world that was already leaning too far towards the president. Still, it's notable that the constitutional crisis that some feared at the outset of the term last fall appears to have been avoided, for now at least. There was talk that the president might ignore Supreme Court opinions, but that talk has receded, says Sakrishna Prakash, a professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. So the court has successfully stood up to the president, he adds. That's important to the court as an institution. The Supreme Court did rule in Mr. Trump's favor in the most important separation of powers case the court has decided in decades. The High Court had for years expressed skepticism that the president is unable to remove leaders of the independent regulatory agencies that make up what Mr. Trump and his allies call the administrative state or unelected career bureaucrats, whom they see as unaccountable to the American public. The case began when Mr. Trump fired Rebecca Slaughter, a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission, claiming her service was inconsistent with the administration's priorities. With its decision in Trump v. Slaughter, a 6-3 ruling that broke along the court's ideological divide, the majority gave the president the authority to fire at will any leader of any regulatory agency, with an exception for the Federal Reserve, which the court in another case this term said played a different role in United States history and tradition. This article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Henry Gass. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, July 20, 2026, is entitled, Ukraine Brings the War into Russia with Drone Attacks. Ukrainian drone strikes deep into Russia's heartland, including a wave on June 29th, are causing fuel shortages and long lines at gas stations, even in Moscow. The attacks are dampening the mood of average Russians more visibly than at any time since the war in Ukraine began 4.5 years ago. For many Russians, particularly in the capital, is the first time the war has struck so close to home. People have been irritated by internet and cell phone disruptions that authorities say are war-related, and small businesses have been hit with tax increases due to the rising costs of the war. But spending hours trying to fill gas tanks is a new level of inconvenience. The increase in drone attacks is putting pressure on the economy, civil infrastructure, and it's certainly affecting the public mood, says Sergei Strokhan, an independent political analyst. Social tension is rising. People are worried. Things are obviously not going on as before. But experts like Mr. Strokhan and Alexei Mukhin, the head of the Center for Political Information in Moscow, say the idea that Russians are likely to panic even as the pressure ramps up is misguided. Though public exhaustion with the war is growing and the number of people who favor peace talks is high, experts say the voices calling for tougher prosecution of the war against Ukraine are also becoming louder and more pervasive. Russian President Vladimir Putin recently made a rare admission of the difficulties during an interview with state TV journalist Pavel Zarubin, conceding that stepped-up Ukrainian attacks against bridges, oil refineries, and fuel trucks are creating problems and certain shortages. According to Russian media, those include restrictions on gasoline sales in at least 20 Russian regions, and price hikes and supply disruptions in several more. the hardest hit region is the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea, annexed by Russia in 2014, where strikes against bridges and other infrastructure here severely reduced fuel supplies, ruined the summer tourist season, and led authorities to declare a state of emergency. During his interview, Mr. Putin insisted the problems were not critical, the damage would be quickly repaired, and Russian air defense forces were developing new weaponry and tactics to counter the Ukrainian assault. Viktor Litovkin, a military expert with the official RIA news agency, says Russian air defenses are mostly coping with the surge in Ukrainian attacks, and only a few incoming drones actually got through, especially around big cities such as Moscow and St. Petersburg. Speaking to state TV, Mr. Putin said the Ukrainian tactic of launching strikes deep into Russia, increasingly hitting civilian targets, has largely psychological aims. Its purpose is to undermine our confidence in ourselves and our capabilities, and ideally to create divisions within Russian society, force Russia to suspend, even temporarily, the advance of our forces along the line of contact, and create conditions for launching negotiations on terms favorable to our adversary, he says. Lev Gudkov, scientific director of Russia's only independent polling agency, the Levada Center, says anxieties are indeed spiking, with more than half of Russians indicating that they pay close attention to war news. While 74% of Russians say they support their troops in Ukraine, more than 60% favor peace talks. Only about one-third say they want the war to continue, though Mr. Gudkov says that percentage has been rising over the past 3 months. The threat of drone attacks has been coming to the fore in public opinion lately, pushing aside other developments in the war zone, he says. The general tendency is for people to mentally separate the attacks on us from what's going on in Ukraine. The number of people who support talks with Ukraine is decreasing, while there are more and more people who feel that Russia should take decisive actions to destroy Ukraine. From the other side, Volodymyr Panayoto, director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, reached via Facebook, says Ukrainians are generally pleased with their forces' improved ability to strike deeper and harder into Russia's heartland. This article was written by special correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor, Fred Weir. Your Christian Science Monitor news continues for Monday, July 20, 2026, with this following article. Once ironclad, United States-South Korea alliance appears weakened. At the National Assembly in Seoul last year, Foreign Minister Cho Hyun said something out loud that many in South Korea had already quietly concluded about the country's closest ally. "I am coming to terms with the fact that the United States of the past, which engaged in really good cooperation with allies and friendly nations, is not the United States of today," Mr. Cho said during a parliamentary inquiry in September. The comments came soon after agents from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested more than 300 Korean workers at a Hyundai plant in Georgia. Mr. Cho offered a rare moment of candor about his country's frayed relationship with the United States. The comments also revealed that the United States might not be dealing with the same South Korea either. "The majority of politicians in Korea have become emboldened or empowered vis-a-vis the United States," says Young-shik Bong, a visiting professor at Yonsei University's Graduate School of International Studies. Cho Hoon's remark shows how much South Korean officials are perplexed by the United States under the Trump administration. With President Trump's second-term ultra-conservative voices in South Korea have been on steady decline, according to Mr. Bong. Meanwhile, public reaction to a South Korean politician, such as the foreign minister, drifting out of lockstep with the United States does not appear to ruffle nearly as many feathers. "It's not just Korea who is questioning how and to what extent United States foreign policy is changing under the Trump administration," says Inwook Kim, an associate professor at Sung Kyukwan University's Department of Political Science and Diplomacy. "The entire world is doing this, right?" President Lee Jae-myung has still managed to survive political accusations labeling him the anti-American president after repeatedly calling for South Korea to move toward a strong, self-reliant defense. He has flat-out ignored Mr. Trump's demands for South Korea's Navy to assist in the Persian Gulf during the Iran War and has openly railed against the conduct of another major United States ally, Israel. At the United Nations, South Korea has voted in favor of recognizing Palestine as a full member state. Those things are a really big change, says Eun-bi Kim, an associate professor at the Korean National Defense University in Seoul. We used to follow whatever the United States decision is. We would basically give up our vote. But recently we have decided to go against the United States, or rather make our voice heard. Officially, South Korea and the United States continue to describe their relationship as ironclad, and experts say there is little doubt over Washington's commitment to defend Seoul in the event of an armed conflict with North Korea. But politicians in Seoul are more willing to be forthright about the need to balance their own national interests against U.S. priorities. President Lee seems to have decided that the Trump administration cannot be trusted on global or economic issues, according to Chi Young Harrison Kim, a professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Experts say South Korea has become more willing to act on its own in recent years, having climbed the ranks as a global economic powerhouse that has also invested in its soft power reach around the world. Successive governments in Seoul have spent time expanding the country's influence in the Middle East, Africa, and Southeast Asia. South Korea has undergone a lot of growth in the last 10 years in terms of economic strength and culture. We are more confident now, says Ms. Kim from Korea National Defense University. We should not understand it as a move away from the United States, but people are aware of the risk of depending too much on one partner. This article was written by contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Kelly Kasulis Cho. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, July 20, 2026, is entitled, Earthquakes Test United States Goal to Run Venezuela. The devastating earthquakes that struck Venezuela on June 24 will have long-term implications for the country's already weak government, which in the eyes of many Venezuelans failed to deliver in an hour of national catastrophe. But the Venezuela crisis also presents a first big test for President Donald Trump's national security strategy. The administration's approach envisions the Western Hemisphere and Latin America in particular as the United States' primary sphere of influence and the first line of defense for national security. After Mr. Trump ousted unpopular President Nicolas Maduro in a military operation earlier this year, the administration said the United States would run Venezuela. But the devastation could upend the White House's strategy, analysts say. The two major earthquakes that have left at least 3,500 Venezuelans dead and tens of thousands more missing or homeless highlight a dysfunctional state apparatus. It subtly complicates the vision this administration has for the region, and it complicates the role of the United States in Venezuela, says Gladys McCormick, Associate Dean at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. The initial United States response to the disaster, substantial when compared with Trump administration contributions to other international disaster response efforts, suggests the administration understands this is a delicate moment, says Britta Crandall, a political scientist specializing in Latin American studies at Davidson College in North Carolina. Yes, you could say the needs over the long term are going to rise into the tens of billions of dollars and that the United States response is nothing even close, she says. But pointing to the doubling of United States assistance from $150 million to $300 million announced June 29, Dr. Crandall adds, it shows that the administration is taking this seriously and suggests it knows the stakes. And those stakes are enormous, analysts agree. There are multiple lessons across Latin America of cases where natural disasters that were poorly addressed by governments led to social and political upheaval. Experts cite examples. One was Nicaragua's 1972 earthquake, which doomed a weak Somoza regime and provided fertile ground for the rise of the current leftist Ortega dictatorship. Another was Haiti's 2010 earthquake, which revealed a hapless government and paved the way to the reign of violent gangs. the magnitude 7.2 and 7.5 earthquakes in Venezuela could clear a path for organized crime groups and drug cartels to solidify their operations in the country, says Dr. McCormick, a specialist in Latin America's political violence and corruption. The United States could blunt such groups' appeal, Dr. McCormick says. There's potentially a huge upside for the United States if it can demonstrate through its response to the Venezuela crisis that its vision for governance can deliver, says Dr. Crandall. And this article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Howard LaFranchi. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, July 20, 2026, is entitled, UN Report, AI Brings Opportunities and Plenty of Risks. Artificial intelligence is advancing faster than humanity's ability to measure or govern it, according to a preliminary report released in July by the United Nations. The risk of humans losing control of AI systems is rapidly growing, the report said. The more AI advances without clear rules, the less say governments and people will have in the outcome, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters at a news conference announcing the report's release. The report found AI had the potential to revolutionize a broad array of social benefits across science, health, agriculture, accessibility, knowledge work, and information technology, including in the development of AI itself. But the scientists also found that the technology was primarily in the hands of a small number of companies and countries, leading to concentrations of wealth, which could lead to authoritarian capture and undermine democratic accountability. The United States controls 75% of global computing power among the world's top 500 AI supercomputers. China accounts for 15%, according to the report. Other nations are concerned that they will be left out of its future. According to the report, AI tools already present cybersecurity risks and leave nations vulnerable to sustained influence operations. AI makes it easier to produce and target persuasive content at scale, including content designed to mislead, contributing to a gradual erosion of information integrity that can weaken the shared reality required for public trust, the report said. The findings represented the collective knowledge of 40 leading scientists from every region of the world. We've opened Pandora's box, the panel's chairs, Nobel Peace Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa of the Philippines and Canadian computer scientist Yoshua Bengio said in written remarks accompanying the report's release. What's coming out is different from anything we've ever lived through, they said, in pace, power, control, and everyday risks. Speaking to reporters, Ms. Ressa said that in the future, human control is not guaranteed. No expert today can tell you that the most advanced systems will do what you instructed to do. In laboratory settings, she said, these systems have already been found to be found to deceive and to resist being shut down. Mr. Bengio said the report showed humanity had reached a turning point with regard to the growing intelligence of machines. As this power grows, it can unlock great benefits if we act wisely, he said, but it can also lead to many perils. Mr. Guterres said he would soon set out proposals to help countries build the capacity to adequately deal with this technology and share in its rewards. This article was written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Aaron Glantz. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, July 20, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening and have a great week.